Good evening. Welcome to CrimeWire, the place for information, news, and most importantly, justice. Our interactive website is www.crimewiresite.com. You can call in any time during the show by dialing 646-478-0982. And remember, you can participate in the show simply by going to the live interactive chat room right here on Blog Talk Radio. If you are a friend or family member who would like to send CrimeWire information on an unsolved or suspicious death case, or have a specific crime-related topic you'd like to have discussed on a future show, email us at thecrimewire@gmail.com. Tonight I'm pleased to welcome back Deborah Gauthier, author of Bright Lights, Dark Places. Deborah was our guest on October 2nd. We ran out of time before we could complete her story. She was one of the first female patrol officers hired under the same standards as men on the Las Vegas Metropolitan Police Department. She spent 21 years on the force, leaving it in 2001. During her tenure, she faced down suspects who were high on PCP, had high-speed chases into oncoming traffic, and used her martial arts skills to subdue burly men. But not all of Deborah's battles while working as a police officer were with criminals. She sometimes faced discrimination in the male-dominated profession, suffering demotions and unsafe working conditions when other officers would not provide backup. Deborah, welcome back to CrimeWire.
Hi, good afternoon, Danny. How are you?
Oh, I'm great. Thank you very much. So we haven't talked in a few weeks. We were, that hour last time went by so quickly, we got cut off about halfway or so through the questions that I wanted to ask you.
Right.
And let me just start out before we get back into it. If you could tell us or tell the listeners where they can find your book.
Actually, a couple places. I'm on Amazon and Barnes & Noble. But if they go to my website, there's links to order the book right from there. And it's www.deborahgauthier. It's DeborahGauthier.TateAuthor.com.
Okay. Now, when we were wrapping up on October 2nd, we had talked a lot about your early life, your bout with cancer, then seeing the ad for applicants for the Las Vegas Metro, and some of your, more exciting capers or cases and incidents that you were involved in. Is there anything, Deborah, you'd like to recap that either we didn't get to last time as far as the job itself went, or anything that you'd like to repeat that we talked about before?
You know, it was funny that we started out with that bout with cancer, because I really believe, Denny, that battle prepared me for the challenges that I would face as a pioneer on the police department. You know, being a pioneer, you pay a price, and I don't believe I was prepared for the cost that paving that way and pioneering in that profession that I would ultimately pay. But that really prepared me, and I really wanted to, because I was at such a young age, face that challenge with cancer, and really it was advanced stages, so you know, I could have died from it, that I wanted to make a difference with my life. And, you know, law enforcement certainly gave me that opportunity to, you know, protect and serve in my community as a servant and to impact lives. You know, I had a opportunity to work with kids and just even out on patrol and be that role model. And that was really, really important to me. So, the career was, you know, it's kind of funny how things happen in life, really, because sometimes you think you're going to be going one way and something tragic will happen and it'll change the course of your life, and that's certainly what happened with that cancer bout. I don't think I would have had a career in law enforcement had it not been for that. But it was wonderful, and I'm so grateful now for the opportunity to have served those 21 years.
So the cancer thing, I can't really stress that enough, because it was not only obviously the crucial thing was your physical recovery, but the
right.
mental toughness.
Yes.
that came along with that from dealing with a life-threatening situation. Certainly had to help you with Metro, and it will do so all through your life.
Absolutely. It really did.
So, yeah, that's an amazing. And you were, what, 18, was it, or so, when you first were diagnosed?
Yeah, I was right out of high school. I was headed to college, and 18 years old, and it was advanced stages. So, you know, they said my youth actually, you know, was beneficial to pull through that because I was young and able to fight that. But, like I said, I would have probably not chosen law enforcement as a career had it been, you know, had I went on to college and done the athletic scholarship that I had at Arizona State. So, but it turned out fine. And looking back, it's been a good journey. Certainly a bumpy road, though.
Yeah, it always bumps.
Right?
Like you were saying, you know, I think most people will say that at some point in their life they experienced a life-changing experience.
Yes.
And that certainly, I think, you can say regarding the cancer, because, as you said, had that not happened, the odds of you getting into law enforcement would have been drastically decreased, I suspect, if you had gone on to college as planned and, you know, the athletic scholarship and everything. So in your case, I think that life-changing experience would certainly be an adequate or accurate descriptor.
Right, absolutely.
Now, when you got on the job then, you answered the ad and made the application for applicants. Did you realize at that point that you were going to be, as you said, a pioneer? Did you realize that there were very few women working the street with Las Vegas Metro at that point?
You know, I didn't have a lot of history other than I found out after I was selected that a gal had applied a year before me, and they had a height and weight requirement back then. So she applied. She filed a complaint against the department that was discriminatory with the Department of Justice. So they came in and said, you have to lift that requirement that, you know, that you're to be a police officer, you have to be, I forget what it was now, maybe 5'8 and whatever. But I would never have made that qualifier. So I was coming in under that, you know, they had just lifted that, and, you know, they had not had women before me, you know, they were going to go right onto patrol, right through the academy, just like a male would, the same career path that a male would have. I was the first. So there was some hostility there that I was walking into that I wasn't aware of. The women before me, there were a few women that had gone before me, but they were dispatchers. They were in traditional jobs. They worked sexual assault, juvenile crimes, more desk jobs. But I was the first that would be going through exactly the same as the men. And their idea was that if I could pass all their tests, and there was no compensation for my height or weight or gender, it was strictly run this obstacle course, you know, pass the written exam, pass the oral boards and all of the physical requirements, and you're in. So I did. And there were, you know, it wasn't just me. There were four other women that passed and were selected for the academy. And I was the only one to make it through that grueling 4 months of training. The other women didn't make it, unfortunately. So we lost over 50% of the class. It was very rigorous and very demanding.
That's a pretty hefty washout rate, isn't it? About 50%?
Oh, yeah, over 50%, yes.
Tell the listeners, if you would, I know we discussed this last time, but it was kind of fascinating, about the snake.
Yeah, I mean, you know, these guys have their little psychological games that they played, and one of the things they did when a recruit was going to wash out is there was a two-way glass from the classroom in their staff office, and they would drop down this black hand in this glass. and we would see it from the classroom. And that when that black hand dropped in the morning, we knew someone was going to wash out. We just didn't know who and when it was going to happen. So we literally just, you know, you were on your on the edge of your seat, not knowing who that was, and it would be because of academics, or you know, you didn't pass a test because we were doing field tests as well as academics and then physical agility. So there were a lot of facets to the training. But when that would happen, they would come in, the academy staff would march in. These were all flat top, you know, military looking guys, like, you know, they're like drill sergeants. They'd come in formation, and they would be carrying this aquarium that had Dr. Doom in it. And Dr. Doom was a boa constrictor. And then at the very end, the last training officer would have a cage full of mice that had each one of our names, basically our number on the mouse. So there were enough mice to cover each one of us. And that number dwindled as the course went on. But when that happened, they would bring that aquarium in, sit it on the table in the front. We would all just be sitting there sweating in our seat, not knowing who it was that was going to wash out. And they would reach in and grab one of the mice and drop it into the tank with Dr. Doom and then march out. So then here we are left watching this mouse in terror in this tank with Dr. Doom. And you know how those boa constrictors are. They start moving towards the prey. And this little mouse was freaking out, trembling, jumping up and down, trying to get away, but no place to escape. And it really was a picture of what was going on with, you know, with us in that situation in those 4 months we were in that training. But as soon as Dr. Doom got a hold of the mouse, you know, squeezed it to death and then swallowed it whole, then the TAC officers would come in and march in front of one of the recruits' desks, snatch their stuff off the table, and then order them to follow him out. And that poor person would walk out in tears, sweat running down their face, because that was the end. There was no appeal process. You were washed out of the academy, and it was done.
Wow. So that's
yeah.
The poor person whose number went into that tank with Dr. Doom, they not only, I would think that would be somewhat of a traumatic experience, at least to some people. And, you know, to be said, come with us, your history.
Yeah, that's it.
It's kind of a bad day, you know.
Very much so. There was a guy, he was one of the victims of that, and he was a Vietnam vet. He had actually done, you know, combat duty in Vietnam, and he was in the academy, and he said he had never experienced something, you know, that psychologically traumatic, even doing war over in, you know, in military combat. But so it was really just, I don't know, I thought it was unnecessary. But I do understand, you know, the process, and they break you down in the academy and then rebuild you as part of the recruits, and everybody works together as a team, and they really build that into you and then prepare you for what you're going to face on the street, because the stress that you're under, Denny, is beyond. I mean, I can't even describe to you, other than it took me 3 years probably to debrief and learn to relax after leaving the department after 21 years. I literally had to learn to become a civilian again. And you don't know you're under that stress until you get away from it. So it's a very stressful job. They have, you know, one of the highest divorce rates. Suicide is certainly up there as well. Alcoholism and all kinds of other issues because of the stress.
Speaking of stress, we have a question from the chat room.
Okay.
Regarding your feeling, you know, generally speaking, I think, maybe not so much today, but I know some years ago, at least, and you, that was probably part of the experience you had, a lot of people, the citizenry in some cases, and certainly some of the male police officers in these different agencies, felt that a woman probably didn't have the physical strength and so forth that a man would do, and therefore might have trouble doing the same job at the same pay and all that kind of thing as a male officer. As far as the physical strength aspect of it, what's your feeling on that? Is that all myth, or is there some to it? Does it depend on the individual?
You know, it really is. Police work is not a job of brute strength. I mean, it really is. You're out there in conflict situations, dealing with, you know, stressful situations, tactical situations. They have really little to do with brute strength. I mean, unless you're kicking a door in, you know, maybe a guy has an advantage of me that's going to kick a door, but that's fine. I just grab the ramming iron and I use that. So you have to work smart. So I would compensate for my lack of physical size by just working very smart. And I shared that story with you about that the guy that was in prison who I confronted by myself. And, you know, they train you really well. So you adapt with what you have. I was, you know, studied martial arts, so I knew how to take care of myself. And like my captain once told me, he said, I was a lieutenant working for him, and he said, you know what? He says, it's not the size of the dog in the fight, it's the size of the fight in the dog. And so I had proven myself because, you know, I'm a fighter, and I don't mean that physically so necessarily, but I mean I could hold my own and certainly prove myself again and again. So, and it was funny, when I was in training new officers, some of the bigger guys, they were the worst in a fight because a lot of those big guys had never been in a fight before. It was the smaller guys that were scrappers. Those guys were dangerous. The same thing with a woman. I mean, it's like, you know, you're like a, I mean, I don't know how many situations I was in where they would just look at me like, what's she going to do in a fight? But then when I got into a situation, and most of the time, Denny, I kept myself out of those situations because I was smart. I used my wit and my, you know, women are just naturally good negotiators. We de-escalate situations oftentimes, unless you got somebody that's just out of their mind on drugs or alcohol or, you know, just acting really stupid, then you've got to be able to handle yourself. But like I said, size is not always the indicator of success in a confrontation. It's what you do with your size and how you react that determine who the winner is at the end of the fight. So, you know, it's funny, I'll share a quick story. I actually tested for the SWAT team when I was on the police department, and they had never had a woman on the SWAT team, and they still have never had a woman on the SWAT team to my knowledge. And so I tested, and they didn't have a physical component to the test. So they certainly could have tested me physically, but they chose not to, strictly by an oral board. And I, you know, of course I didn't make it because they looked at me and said, well, you're a woman and you can't do this. And I said, hey, if you have any reservations about what I can and cannot do, why don't you just test me physically? Because I was in great physical shape. I think my body fat back then was 9%. I was an animal. I mean, I ran triathlons. I was a marathon runner. So I was certainly able to handle myself physically. And I kept myself in good shape, which was, you know, that's another indicator that you're going to, you know, how you approach just your career. And I kept myself in really good physical shape. So I mean, if you have a male officer who might outweigh me by 100 pounds but is in terrible physical shape, he doesn't take care of himself, and then you put me beside him, who do you think is going to win in a fight? Well, the officer who's more in shape, right?
Right.
So, yeah, so it's size is really, it's really misleading. There's so many other factors more so than size. So that's really just a myth. Like you said, it's an old traditional thing that people have, you know, men have relied on before, but women today are different. The training is excellent in these fields, and even women in military now are doing combat duties, and it's not all brute strength. And unless you're doing, you know, I have a cousin who's a firefighter, and she's hauling hoses and big ladders and all of those things. That requires a lot more physical strength than a police officer driving a police car. And I can't remember who told me this, but they said, How much strength does it take to pull the trigger on a gun?
True. Very true.
Right?
We have a follow-up question related. And through your personal experience or when you were on patrol and possibly as a supervisor when you kind of had to keep tabs on things that were going on,
right.
Do you think there was a tendency for male officers who worked with, who were partnered with, rode with female officers to be protective? Do you think they ever had lapses where they were tried to avoid certain things because they were worried that their female partner might get injured or something.
Are you asking me if I had remembered any experiences like that?
Yeah, do you think it is that another myth, or just did you ever encounter something, you know, when you were actually working with a male officer, or perhaps when you were in supervision, where that subject came up, where somebody may have done things a little differently if they had a female partner?
I didn't personally experience that, and, you know, even as a supervisor, a sergeant, and later a lieutenant, with women working under me in my command, like I said, there were not a lot of women out there, so... But the women that were there, because the training is so stringent and Metro has a high standard of training their officers, that was not the case. I mean, I know a few times when I bailed out a few guys that were in situations life-threatening that had I not intervened or had I not come at the time I came right then, those officers probably would have lost their lives. So... You know, again, it's a mindset and a mentality that I think is the old school mentality, and that is starting to change and break down as women are coming more in numbers, and they start integrating the department, so they're more diverse instead of just this male dominated departments.
So, again, you know, the idea that there were not that many females on the force at that point, like you say, you were one of the few at that time. Do you
right.
think over the years, now you did 21 years, did you see a lot of changes over that time frame in the attitude toward women and so forth? Did you see any changes at all for the good or bad?
You know, I did. And you know what was encouraging me is a younger guys coming on who had mothers that were in the workforce. A lot of them been raised by single moms that were working in the workforce. Their whole mentality and mindset and even respect and honor of women in the workforce was much different than that old regime. So I saw the younger guys, they didn't have the issues that the older men had. They just, I mean, if you pulled your weight, did your job, you know, they would have you as a partner like anybody else. And I heard that time and time again with the younger officers, the newer officers coming in. So I started seeing that change. What sadly has not happened, at least in this agency, is those men rising up in the ranks. We still have these boys running the show, and they're the ones that are threatened by women, and they are disrespectful and dishonoring of women. And until these men, I call them men because these are men honor women, boys don't, because the boys are the ones that have the issues that it's jealousy or insecurities with themselves. It has nothing to do with the women and their abilities. It's more about them and their issues. So until that happens, and it hasn't happened, and it's sad, because until that happens, you're not going to really have the equality in your department. And as a result, the community really benefits because it reduces officer use of force situations and deadly force situations when you have a force that is more equal. In other words, more women, men and women working side by side, because we bring a strength to the table that the men, not all the men, have, and that is communication, negotiation, and just a different approach to policing.
Now, Deborah, not talking solely about Metro, but police agencies in general.
Right.
What can an agency do to encourage these boys turning into men attitude-wise regarding women in the force? Obviously, if they go too far, if the boys go too far in disrespect and so forth, I assume that depending on the agency, there probably is some violation of policy or procedure. But if they stop short of that, or it's the locker room type stuff, does that all hinge on the management? Does it have to come from the management down, that attitude, and try to get the people down the chain to think that same way?
Absolutely. It always starts at the top. I tell people, you know, if you want to know what's going on with your agency, look at the person in the top position, because whatever that person's attitude and their, you know, they're the ones that set the tone for the rest of the department, and the managers will line up. And if you set that tone that, hey, I'm not going to tolerate this kind of stuff, and have integration up in the upper ranks too. That's what I was trying to do, move up the ranks, you know, being the pioneer. And, you know, because I was trying to move up the ranks and they knew what I was doing, that's when I became a target and was taken out, you know, when I was ready to become a captain. Just unnecessary. What a loss of tax dollars and just a waste of a career. Just because of people were threatened with me moving up those ranks. Because, and sadly enough, had they allowed it, they would have been more successful. They would have been successful. Because now we still have this mentality going on, and the public is tired of it, quite frankly. I think the community is tired of the use of force, you know, the bullying, the nonsense that goes on. They're just tired of that stuff. We can't afford it anymore. We can't afford to pay out any more lawsuits. So when you have, if you really want to make a difference, it's a person sitting in that top position that is elected here in our community. So the community has the ability to elect their sheriff. And it's also having your females, the qualified females up in the ranks so that they're part of the leadership and they're sitting at the tables where the decisions are being made. And like I was doing, also having them in the training role. When I was a sergeant, I was the first woman on the academy staff, so I got to break that barrier and be a sergeant overseeing all the recruits as they were going through training. And I'll tell you, when I was a sergeant, I didn't have Dr. Doom. I didn't need Dr. Doom.
Let me ask you this, and we have another chat room comment I'll address first. Says, I know a gal works in the LV jail who is absolutely gorgeous. I asked her how she gets the male prisoners to respect her, and she said that from day one she sets the boundaries, makes it very clear, and she doesn't have any problems.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely, and that's really what it's all about.
I was just thinking of something as you were talking. When you got into a supervisory position,
mm-hmm.
obviously you were aware of you know the male-dominated issue and so forth. But when you get to be in a supervisory role, I assume you have to be kind of careful because if you go overboard the other way, in other words, you know, where it looks like you're solely trying to help the women, the other females, and so forth, then that can be bad too. So you got to do be fair, I guess, to get the respect of everyone,
right?
The men and the women who work under you or for you,
right?
And because if you go the other way, one way or the other, then that's probably going to boomerang and come back at you.
It would, and, you know, I think in all respect, due respect, I was probably harder on the women than I was on the men, not even realizing it, because I wanted to make sure that the women that were there, that, you know, they had the respect, and there were no compromises, and, you know, they carried their own weight and all of those kind of things. And so, if anything, I was probably a little harder on the women than I should have been. Just because of what I had to go through. And, I wanted to make sure no other woman had to go through what I had to go through because it was very painful, Danny. You've read my book and you know the price that I paid. I mean, and my reason for writing the book is I wanted to, number one, open people's eyes to what really goes on behind the scenes in law enforcement so they have a respect for what those officers do and they're not so quick to criticize or judge situations. They're a little bit more open-minded because they know what goes on. And number two, to encourage women to get into the career field and even men that are being touched by my book because I'm so transparent and open about the book is in my experiences, even them, they're getting more sensitized to, oh, I had no idea that my conduct was having that kind of effect on you. And, you know, it's like opening their eyes as well. So You know, and that's what it's all about. It's about leaving a legacy. It's about making a place better than when you got there. It's about making sure that people don't have to go through all that you went through, and that the women now can break that glass ceiling and go further than I went. And the men are now looking at women not as an enemy, but as an ally. And that was my goal when I was there.
You know, I think this is a good point. We got talking about so many other interesting things. We still hadn't gotten into the other part of your story, which is the discrimination and why you ended up leaving and so forth. So why don't we get into that now? We've talked a little bit about some of the things, but why don't you tell us not the police work, but the office politics type stuff and what happened and what you were faced with and what decisions you had to make.
Yeah, it was, you know, I was promoted to sergeant in 1985. I was about 5 years into my career, so I got promoted to sergeant pretty quick. I was a field training officer and was really moving towards promotion. And then I worked a variety of assignments when I was a sergeant. I was a sergeant almost 10 years and worked on the street in training. I worked detective work. I also worked a special unit for the sheriff's office where we did inspections of other units, other bureaus and departments within the agency. So really got a great grasp and invaluable training on running bureaus and budgets and the whole operational side of law enforcement, administrative side, that you really can't learn that in a book. It has to be experience. So, you know, I moved. I was good. I mean, let's just face it. I mean, I did well on the tests, and I did well in each of the assignments. I always gave 110%. It was always about my men and women at work for me. I was not there to, you know, build a name for myself, but to serve my, you know, my officers and take good care of them, make sure their needs were met, and to do a good job for the community because they pay for us. But I really started to get the opposition or feel it when I made lieutenant, and that happened in 1994. And when I made lieutenant, it was a regime change. Now, in police work, very political, especially where you have elected sheriffs, and we have elected sheriff here in Las Vegas. So I, unfortunately, supported the other candidate who was running, a guy who, in my opinion, had integrity and the ability to run the department and would have really changed the whole dynamics of what was going on there in terms of women and law enforcement, because he was a fair guy. But anyway, he didn't win the election. And so when he lost, they buried him. And everybody that supported him that was in, had any rank, and I was one of them, was a target. So when I made lieutenant, you know, I started running into the opposition right away. I mean, the first assignment I got as with my new rank of lieutenant was to a captain who worked on this guy's campaign staff. So, I mean, I knew I was going to have issues. And the first day I got there, the guy had sat in a briefing room and told all the guys that he was just really disappointed that I was going to be the lieutenant. I mean, just really disrespected me in front of the troops. And so I didn't have this guy's support, and he transferred me 8 times in 1 year. I mean, it was one thing after another. The guy was just relentless, just trying to set me up to fail. I mean, just, you know, it was tough. And it was, I call that in my book, my year of hell. I mean, it literally emotionally and physically took a toll on me that year, just because of the tension and working in that kind of oppressive environment with this guy. But, and you know what, when I went to appeal to the deputy chief to get a transfer from, this guy was his best friend. I mean, this guy who I was working for, he says the appeal's denied, your probationary lieutenant. So, I mean, it was like, finally when it got so bad, he said, okay, I'm going to approve your transfer. He transfers me to the guy's best friend, who's another captain. And then they assigned me to work 12-hour shifts in a jail as a screening lieutenant. So, I mean, it was just, you know, and they wouldn't give me command as a lieutenant. I mean, if you don't have men working for you, you don't have, you know, men and women a command, then you're not really, you don't really have rank. It's just like women in military. Until you do combat, you don't really have an opportunity to promote because it all happens during battles, when you're out on the street, when you're out in, you know, in combat situations. That's where, when you get the promotions, that's where those come from. And in law enforcement's a lot like that. So, you know, it really started, the opposition really intensified as I started moving up the ranks. And when I was about to become a captain, and this was kind of funny how this happened, I had, because I went through all this adversity and I just bounced back, whatever they threw at me, I just took it and did my best with whatever hand was dealt me. I just did a great job. I just kept my attitude in check. That I actually caught the attention of a deputy chief who had a bureau that was in shambles, and he needed a strong commander to come in and clean the place up and get things turned back around. And so he interviewed me for the job, and I got it. So technically, I was a captain. I was a lieutenant doing a captain's job. And because there were all these issues and challenges, I got to turn all those things around and face all those. When I went to the captain's assessment center, I was already prepared for that. I had already hands-on training and been in the position for an entire year before I even applied. And fortunately, the chief, who was a head of human resources, and I was a community relations bureau commander, but he oversaw human resources as well. Well, he changed the policy. Instead of having an inside assessment center panel that would have inside people, they had an outside panel. So these were majors and chiefs from other agencies that came in to sit on our captain's assessment center. So they didn't know me from Adam. And these guys were sharp, and they just ranked you according to how you performed in the assessment. It was a full-day assessment. I came out number one, Denny, hands down. And those majors told the sheriff, hey, we'd love to have that gal on our department. Man, she's got what it takes. We'd love to have her on our department. And this guy, he was livid. Remember, I didn't support him in the election.
Yeah.
So he went and told a bureau, you know, briefing room full of the guys. I mean, this is how arrogant these guys are. Just openly, he doesn't know who is in the audience, but he tells these guys, as long as I'm the sheriff, she will never be a captain. And he was right. He was right. I mean, he had one of his boys start covertly recording my conversations. He actually taped a recorder on his leg. I found out from my secretary that was going on. And they used, you know, things taken out of context. They used those tapes against me, and it would result in a two-rank demotion for a bogus discrimination charge by this male sergeant who was, you know, substandard by any means. And any guy he worked for, he would have been kicking a can. But I had to deal with this guy, and, he ended up filing this bogus charge, and then they used those tapes against me and said that I retaliated against him. And they caught me on tape saying that it was time for him to leave. If he didn't like working for me, he could transfer out. And they said that was retaliation. I was threatening him. I mean, how ridiculous.
Deborah, we got another chat room question about you being covertly taped. Did that violate anything? Was there any illegality there? Apparently not, but...
Well, in other states, it's a felony to do that. But in Nevada?
The commenter said this sounds like a bad episode of Law and Order.
Boy, isn't that true? You know, had it been other state, people would have been going to jail. But here in Nevada, as long as it's face-to-face, you don't have to reveal your tape recording somebody. It's only when you're on the telephone that you have to say, you know, this call may be recorded or you are being recorded. But according to our law, you don't have to divulge that. So that was going on. And you know what's funny is after they used that against me, did you know they made a policy that you could not covertly record another officer on the department after they destroyed my career?
So
that
after
no one could go and use it against them. Do you see what I'm saying?
they did what they wanted to do and then covered so it wouldn't happen to them.
Correct, yeah.
How sweet it is, huh?
Oh, yeah.
Now, so you're dealing with all this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Well, what did you see as your option? I know you're a scrapper.
Right.
And obviously, in fact, the chat room says your story, that's amazing. I can't believe she stuck through it all. I really admire her.
Oh,
but,
yeah,
you know,
thank
we
you.
Know that that you weren't going to throw in the towel at the first sign of trouble. But what did you see? Did you think there was a chance you could win, or did you figure that the deck was pretty much stacked against you?
Boy, I'll tell you what, you know, in my, like I said, failure was not an option when I started this, because if they take out the Pioneer, it not only impacts the Pioneer, but it affects women coming behind me. It sets them back, and it did. It had the same effect on several women coming up behind me. They did the same thing to them what they did to me. A lot of those women went out on medical retirements. They didn't fight like I did. But, you know, my options were simply, do I fight or do I leave? Do I just pack it up and say, okay, I'm retiring early? Do I do that, or do I file a lawsuit? And that's what I ended up doing, was filing a discrimination, a hostile work environment lawsuit against the department. Now, the sad thing is I couldn't find an attorney that would take my case locally. They were all intimidated. Nobody wanted to go up against Metro.
So you had to go outside of the area?
Well, I tried to, and the gal who was going to take my case, very high-profile attorney in Los Angeles that did the tailhook scandal here with a naval female officer at the Hilton Hotel, won that case. She said, you know, Deborah, good luck. That's a tough area, and you know what? I can't see justice happening in Las Vegas. It's too entrenched. I mean, they just take care of each other, and nobody wants to, you know, to take that one on, and rightfully so. You know, my attorney, the guy that I finally got to take my case, his office was broken into mysteriously, and they went through files. I mean, the guy was intimidated. He was freaking out, and I noticed right after that he backed off completely, so I had to go get another gal. So I had to even change lawyers in the midst of this whole battle. And I just knew, I could tell Denny, you know, I'm fighting an uphill battle. I'm fighting a battle that cannot be won. And the judge that we pulled on the civil case signs the search warrants for the narcotics officers. So you know what I'm saying? So I'm like, oh, man. So, but you know, and I even had a job offer during the middle of all this stuff in Florida to run their training for the whole state. But, you know, there was something in me that just says, you know, I can't give this up. I have to fight this to the end. And I fought them for 4 years. And, you know, when you file a lawsuit, you can pretty much sign off your job, your career is over at that point, even if you win.
Yeah.
Because, there's just no winning that battle. Although the women behind me benefited, for me it was over. And, you know, they ended up terminating me after 4 years into this thing. Another bogus, they used an informant against me to fire me. An informant. Who was lying under, you know, the polygraph, lied under the polygraph. I mean, this guy, it was just like, it's like, whose side are you on? I'm one of you. You know, and that was the hardest thing, I think the most tragic and the most difficult challenge for me is I grew up with these guys, blood, sweat, and tears, out on the street with them, back their butts, gut in situations, you know, fights and stuff. I mean, I did the same job as these guys, and to have them turn against me like that, their sister officer, was beyond anything that I can even describe to your listeners, the pain of that. It's like your own family members coming against you. It's just painful.
So eventually they got you. I mean, like you say, it was an uphill battle. You did all you could, 4 years of the fight. But once you left the department, once you were out, there had to be, I suspect there could have been some anger, you know, some bad taste in your mouth from what you were put through and how they went about getting you. But did you also feel any relief of not having the fight over with, or no?
It was, I'm sure there was some relief, but it was like my career was cut short. I really loved what I did for work. A lot of my friends, my whole community was inside the department. So not only did I lose my career, Denny, I lost a lot of friends in all of it because, you know, everybody was afraid to associate with me because, you know, they would just target them as well. So I mean, it was hard. It was like losing your family. And, you know, I remember that 2001 is when I was fired, and that was the same year when 9/11 hit our nation. And I remember standing in my living room watching those planes fly into the towers and just seeing my career and the evil that was hit me and my career, and those towers falling was just like a picture of my life. And I was sitting there and just in rubble and just, where do you go from there? And it was just like, what I love about America, Americans, is we rebuild, you know, we get up, we keep going. And that's what I had to do. I had to get up and keep going. And that's why I ran for sheriff. The next year, after they terminated in 2001, I actually ran for sheriff in 2002.
I want to get a couple more quick questions in from the chat room.
Okay.
First question, have you gotten any threats, anonymous or otherwise, as a result of your book?
Absolutely not. No threats. In fact,
and second question, do you fear some type of retaliation now?
No, absolutely. You know what? First of all, I have no fear. I've gone through everything that you could possibly go through, and fear is out of me. So fear is not even part of my makeup. There has not been any retaliation. In fact, my book was picked up by a major publishing company because it's written in a positive light. They would not have published a book that was vindictive or derogatory or slanderous in any way. They wouldn't have gotten behind that. So the book has had the opposite effect. I've had even, I tell people now, my enemies are my friends on Facebook. A lot of these guys that were part of all that nonsense have since retired, as I have been gone a while. And they have a different perspective on things. And they are reading my book, Denny, and I'm telling you, those men are coming to me and saying, you know what, Deb, I am sorry that you had to go through that. I'm sorry I didn't do more. I'm sorry I didn't stand up for you. I'm sorry. They're feeling the pain of the injustice. So the book is not meant to be an expose on corruption. I could have certainly gone that route, but this book is redemptive. This book is not only the story of overcoming and, you know, just going through that battle and the challenges that I faced and being that pioneer on that journey, but it's also my battle and my journey out of darkness into the light. So it has a spiritual piece to it. So it's had just the opposite effect. It has not. It's not that kind of a book at all. It's really a book of hope.
The chat room comment is that maybe these people who are now friending you on Facebook and so forth, maybe they didn't realize the extent of what you went through until they read your book.
That's correct. That's exactly right. And that's why it took so much out of me to write that book. It was a 10-year journey to write this book, Denny, because the first time I wrote it out of my pain. And that would have been the book that I'm sure people would have not been happy about. But I put that book aside for a good, you know, 10 years while I, you know, went through healing and just getting restored and getting rid of all the bitterness and the anger, just working through all those things so I could rewrite my book out of my passion and honor the men and women that I served with. And the ones that were, you know, up to no good, they know who they are. I don't have to highlight them. I mean, they're in my book. The names are in there. I don't use last names, but first names are in there. And, you know, they know who they are. So, you know, what am I going to gain from trying to get back at these guys? Like your readers or listeners said, a lot of them probably weren't even aware they were doing what they did, and it had that kind of effect. So that's the reason I wrote the book.
Deborah, I want to, before we have to wrap up here, a couple of things I wanted to mention, or one in particular.
Okay.
There are various ways that officers can send, send a message that they're unhappy with somebody. It could be a sexual thing, you know, male-dominated, doesn't like the females. It could be just a personal thing or whatever. But if there's a fellow officer who the troops or some of the troops aren't really happy with, there are certain things they can do to make that person uncomfortable or perhaps get them to resign or so on and so forth.
Right.
One of those things is, and this is the one that's not politics necessarily, I mean, it goes beyond that I really despise because it happened to me at one point, is when people don't respond as backups or drag their feet getting mm-hmm. to a backup situation. Because now it's more than just, you know, getting transferred here. I mean, that's bad enough.
Yeah.
But you or the public, in other words, the officer who needs assistance
mm-hmm.
or the public in general can end up being hurt or killed.
Yes.
If somebody doesn't show up.
Mm-hmm.
And that, to me, if I've always thought that if anybody can ever prove that an officer or officers could have responded and didn't over their time, they should be prosecuted. I mean, that's my opinion, because I think that's one of the lowest things you can do.
Absolutely.
Don't agree with any, you know, I mean, all this other crap, but when you place someone's life in danger, and it could be, because here's my thought. One thing, appropriate backup can diffuse a situation. If it's a borderline thing and, you know, maybe you got a crowd issue or a bar fight
mm-hmm.
or that type of
mm-hmm.
Domestic, extra force or extra officers present might tilt the thing back in the favor of a peaceful resolution.
Right.
Where no backup and 8 or 10 or 20 people against one might
mm-hmm.
encourage the mob or the bad guy
right.
to go forward and escalate. And if they can't get there, if they're legitimately trying, just can't get there in time to defuse the situation, then at least if they're there, they can help and provide the assistance necessary to defuse it at that time before there's any serious damage or injury. And maybe it's just a pet peeve with me. How do you feel about that? Do you agree that failure to back up a fellow officer is about as low as it gets?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, but you know what? Try to prove those situations, or, you know, I mean, it's hard. I mean, I told you when I was on the department, my African-American brothers told me that they were threatened not to back me up because these guys were not going to back me up when I was out on the street, you know, these particular guys on my squad. And they just said, you know what, you're on your own out here. We just want to make sure you know that. And, you know, we'll cover you as much as we can, but these guys have threatened us. I mean, I had my, you know, my life threatened. I had dildos hanging off my locker room, you know, my locker in the locker room. I mean, just boy games. And like you said, you know, it could have cost me my life. Fortunately, it didn't, but those are tough because it's like, you know, once you're in there, you don't snitch another officer. You just, you know, go along with the crowd, and it's very dangerous.
Deborah, I don't know where this time is going. We ran a little bit over again. I'm going to have to wrap up here, but before I do, I'd
okay.
like you again to tell the listeners where they can find Bright Lights, Dark Places.
Okay. You can find it at Amazon. It's on Kindle, Nook, at Barnes & Noble. You can also check out my website at www.deborahgauthier, D-E-B-R-A. GAUTHIER Tate author.com.
Okay, Deborah, thanks so much for coming back. I'm sorry we had the long delay in between, but I'm glad you were able to get back on. And perhaps you'll come back sometime in the future.
Absolutely. My pleasure, Denny. Enjoyed it immensely.
Okay, and the best of luck to you and with your book.
Thank you so much. Bye-bye.
Thanks, Deborah. Bye-bye. A fascinating story, at least for me, to talk to Deborah. It's quite a time she went through, and you know, God bless her. She stuck with it. She was a scrapper. She hung in there as long as she could, and I admire her. And then writing the book, so that's my hat's off to her. The reason I wanted to take the final few minutes tonight was. With the passing of Susan Murphy Milano, my co-host and friend, there's going to be a couple of changes to Crime Wire. Susan, of course, was a dynamo, and she really had access to all kinds of domestic violence, intimate partner homicide cases that I don't have. What we're going to do is starting December 4th, Peter Hyatt, statement analyst Peter Hyatt, will be hosting some of the Crime Wire shows. We're going to more or less alternate weeks. It won't be an exact alter depending on our individual schedules, but Peter will be taking some of the shows, and I'll be taking some. When on Peter's nights, he will be doing, it's be his agenda, his guests, his cases, he's going to profile, and so on and so forth. I will be doing likewise, but we're going to be doing a little more on my episodes of crime-related topics and some high-profile cold cases and so forth. So, and we're, for example, next week on the 20th, my guest is going to be Karen Storstein. And Karen is a psychic medium and highly respected psychic medium. I know that not everyone believes in psychics, not everyone believes in the paranormal and so forth. But for those who do, you might find the show interesting. We're going to have callers whose cases have previously been profiled on CrimeWire or through Citizens Against Homicide. And she's going to do live readings on the phone during the show and try to get some answers as to what happened to the loved ones of the callers regarding their deaths. So that's going to be, I think, quite interesting, and I'm really looking forward to it. And if all goes well, we will have Karen back on a periodic basis to also do live readings. So I'm quite excited about that. And on the 27th of November, I'm going to be doing the first of two shows. The one's going to be the first on the 27th, next one on December 11th, the follow-up, regarding the murder of Bugsy Siegel. That would have to be one of the ultimate cold homicide cases, probably, because of his notoriety. Of course, that murder was in 1947. Bugsy was shot. He was in Beverly Hills at the home of his girlfriend, Virginia Hill. And there was a gentleman, a friend of his named Al Smiley, in the room with him, and someone with a apparently a 30 caliber carbine fired a shot from approximately 14 feet outside the window and got Bugsy and blew his eye out and so forth. So it was quite a thing, and no one was ever charged in that. And one of our previous guests, Llewellyn Smiley, she's the daughter of Al Smiley, who was physically in the room with Siegel at the night of the murder. She introduced me to a gentleman here in Vegas who believes he knows and can prove who killed Siegel. So I met with this gentleman last Thursday evening, and we spent about 3 hours going over his evidence. And I got to tell you, he makes a very compelling case. He's got documentation, photos, and I won't go into too much detail right now, but it's quite a case, and we're quite a evidence that he's gathered to support his theory. So we're going to do the first show without taking calls to let him lay out what he believes happened to Siegel and why, and by who. And when he's back on the show 2 weeks later, we'll finish up any more information that didn't get out in the first show, and also take calls from people. So anybody that's a sleuth, an amateur sleuth, you can listen to the presentation on the 27th, do your own research if you'd like or whatever, and then you can discuss your findings, your feelings on December 11th. So we're looking forward to that as well. Anyway, so things are going to be continuing on a tad different than they have been in the past. And the show at Effect of the Fourth will be starting at 7 p.m. Eastern instead of 9 p.m. Okay, thank you very much for listening tonight. I really appreciate it. And again, thanks to our guest, Deborah Gauthier. Also, thanks to our Director of Research, Kim Colton, and Public Relations Team at Imagine Publicity. Our next show will be on Tuesday, November 20th. Tune in as we continue to analyze cases that wreak havoc on families looking for answers and seeking justice, and discuss crime-related topics with the experts. Until next time, God bless and stay safe. Good night.